Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm bloody excited.
Yeah, I actually went for a swim this morning. It was wonderful. And there was all this rock floating on the waves.
What do you mean?
A volcano went off the coast of New Zealand and had this huge raft and has finally come across to Australia after a gap of about a year.
Oh, wow. What a surprise. You weren't injured, were you?
Oh, no. They're just little pebbles, light-coloured pumice about the size of the tip of your finger just floating on the water.
Wow. Delightful. Magical.
Magical.
Well, we're going to be diving into the world of science, and I'm already seeing a whole bunch of really great summer science questions as we all head towards the Christmas break. Give us a call right now, 1300 055 36. If you have an answer or a comment and you can't get through, we'd love to hear from you. 0439 757 555 is the text line number, or you can tweet Dr. Carl direct, DOCTORKARL. Should we jump into it?
Into it.
All right. Earl's calling in from the Gold Coast. Hi, Earl.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. What's your question?
I'm a surfer, and every time I go for a surf, you've got to really blow your nose all the time. But on dry land, you never have to. So I was just wondering, I always wondered why that's the case.
I think you'd be able to do, if you did the experiment of blocking your nose, which would be a nasty thing to do because you'd have difficulty in breathing, you would find that there would be no water running up your nose and then into the sinuses. So some of the sinuses drain into the nose. A sinus is a technical term for a cavity that's got only one way in. So when you think about two people kissing, basically you've then got a single creature joined by two bums. You've got a bum and then a complete tube going from one bum all the way through into the mouth of the other person, that's through the other bum. And so that's a continuous path. But a sinus, you go in, you have to come back the way you came. So you have sinuses in your head, and they fill up with water. And what I do love is after going for a surf and getting tossed around a bit, every now and then about 10 minutes after I've got home, 2 hours after I've got home, I'm leaning over the table, I'm reading the newspaper while standing, and then suddenly it looks like about half a litre of seawater comes out of my sinus and straight onto the newspaper.
Gross.
Gross.
Yeah, it could happen all day for me.
Yeah, now I know this is a nasty experiment, but just for fun, you could do the nose clips thing.
Yeah.
And then just try it. I mean, it'll be messy. And then see if you no longer dribble water out of your nose.
Okay.
And can you ring us back? And then you could get some of that. And if you write it down, even better. And then you can get a fun pack.
A 2014 fun pack. Give us a call back next year. Let us know how you go, Earl. Thanks for call.
No worries. Love you, Zan.
See you, Earl. Thank you. Aaron is calling in from Townsville this morning. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Aaron.
How are you doing, Doctor?
Oh, hello.
Hi,
what's your question?
I was just wondering if you were trapped on a desert island and you were in the seawater, would that help you rehydrate?
You're not going to expand. You're not going to collect or transmit any water across your skin into your body, except on your fingers and toes.
Okay.
Because there you have lots of sweat glands, and the water does come in through the sweat glands backwards, and then that sets off a sympathetic nervous reaction, which then causes your skin to contract on your fingers and toes, thus getting the wrinkles. So the amount of water coming in there would be of the order of a tenth of a milliliter, maybe a milliliter tops.
Yep.
So basically, you're not going to get any water coming in there. I'm trying to think, you can't drink the water because that will bring you closer to death than and dehydration.
Because of the salt.
Yep. Yeah, the best thing to do is to drink no. I don't know if you can get any water absorption via a salt water enema. I don't know would help. I don't think so. Basically, the best thing you can do is to drink no water at all for 24 hours and force your kidneys into a water-conserving regime. And then, after 24 hours, whatever water you have, you drink only in very small amounts and then you preserve it for as long as you can.
So hopefully you don't get trapped on a desert island and you're not faced with these problems, Aaron.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
No worries, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's head to Laura, who's calling in from Moonee Ponds. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura. Hi, congratulations on the number one, guys.
Thank you. Yeah. For anybody who's just joining us, the Christmas number one song that Lindsay and a whole bunch, the cream of the crop of the Australian music industry, and Dr. Carl, you're in the choir.
Dr. Zan.
And I was in the choir too, has just gone number one on the charts. We made it with help of everyone who bought it in Australia. Thank you so much.
That's number one in Australia.
Number one. Got to keep it there.
That's my first number one hit single.
It was a team effort, and obviously the biggest team is the Triple J listeners who put it there, so thank you so much. Laura, what's your question for Dr. Carl?
It's a little bit of an embarrassing one. I never really sort of had much BO all my life, but I've sort of been noticing a bit of a stronger smell over the last few months, and I was trying to work out if it was maybe food-related, and I think I've nailed it down to when I eat chicken. I'd heard that red meat can cause it, but I'd never heard of chicken being related to it. And I was just wondering if Dr. Carl could tell me if that's plausible and maybe why.
Yes, you have different types of sweat gland around the body, and they basically come out with sweat as a liquid to cool you down. But they have other effects, such as on your hands, hands and feet, you've got lots of sweat glands, and they help you get a better grip, firstly working on the ground, and secondly to grab stones in the water. And then when it comes out of your armpits, it's a signalling thing, because we humans are a social creature. And so thanks to smells coming out of the armpit, not smells, chemicals, yep, they can be subconsciously but not consciously smelt by a member of the opposite gender to think, I like your immune system.
Mm.
And so this was done with T-shirts, and to summarise it, if the woman is resistant to diseases A, B, C, and the man is resistant to diseases X, Y, Z, then the baby, presumably, will be resistant to diseases A, B, C, and X, Y, Z. And then just last week, I came across a case of a woman who, because she unfortunately had a tendency to blood clots, had to take a certain type of blood clot thinner. It's a chemical. It's got a fancy name.
Yeah.
And suddenly, she started getting bitten by mozzies. She's got a large family. So then she thought, I'll just go off them for 2 weeks. And she went off it for 2 weeks, no mozzies. And they're out of the barbecue and nobody's getting bitten by mozzies. Then she goes on to it again for 2 weeks, and then the mozzies love her. So I'm guessing that the chemical is coming out almost certainly through her armpits. And so it may well be that there is some chemical somewhere in the chicken that could be either a natural part of the chicken, or it could be part of the processing after the chicken has been killed, that is then processed by your body and then in this strange way comes out through your armpits.
Ah.
Now, have you tried different forms of chicken? Like, are you buying the pre-cooked chicken? Is it the raw chicken? Is it the...
It's I buy the raw chicken that's got the no added hormones, and sometimes like the pre-roasted chicken, but also the ones with the no hormones. But yeah, should I avoid it then?
Well, firstly, chickens haven't had hormones in them in Australia for about 3/4 of a century.
Mm.
So it's like saying they're also guaranteed not to have uranium, plutonium and little bits of diamond dust. But if you do the experiment with yourself and then try different forms of chicken, then it just turns out to be the luck of the draw that your body, combined with something in the chicken, does that.
Okay.
And then you're just stuck with no chicken if you want to reduce your BO.
Let us know how you go, Laura. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
See you later.
Bye.
Someone from the UK is listening, hello, online, and they've asked you a question, Dr. Carl.
Hi, Dr. Glyn Martin. And the question is, how do they get the tiny particles to hit each other in the Large Hadron Collider? And sure, when galaxies collide, they do not have planets running into each other or stars, because space is large and planets and stars are small. However, they confine them into a bean maybe a millimetre or two across, and they have billions, trillions of the little buggers. I've actually seen and touched the bottle that holds the hydrogen. So they got this multi-billion dollar thing, which when I say multi-billion dollars, is still cheaper than 3 American warplanes, B-2s. And there's a hydrogen bottle that they bought for 14 euros about 5 years ago. It's got another 5 years worth. So what it's like 2 swarms of bees. Huge numbers of bees confined to a narrow path, and that way they will hit each other. They're very small, but there's lots of them, and they have millions and trillions of goes going around the ring, and they run it for several days at a time.
A special Christmas question for someone who is unable to call, but if you're in Australia, we'd love to hear from you. 1-300-055-36 is the number. Ryan is calling in from Newey this morning. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, how are you going, doctors?
Great.
Hi, Dr. Ryan.
What's your question?
I've got a badly herniated disc in my back, and it gives me nerve pain down my left leg.
Mm-hmm.
And I get one of the symptoms is goosebumps. So I'm wondering what causes goosebumps, other than that one, obviously.
Okay.
And what do they have a purpose?
Yes. Firstly, with regard to the disc, think about a donut, and that's the outside of the disc. And then inside that, there's some jelly. And now let's go back to the disc. It is not just a straight donut. Imagine that the donut is made up of slices of wood cut to the right shape but laid on top of each other. And the jelly is sneaking out between those slices and then landing on a nerve pushing on a nerve in your sympathetic nervous system and causing one of the symptoms of a sympathetic nerve attack. So we mentioned this before, that the sympathetic nervous system response is the four Fs, the fight, the flight, the fright, and the making love. And basically, you come around a corner, there's a killer kangaroo or a killer rabbit, and you immediately go into a preordained, pre-programmed response. And part of it is that your pupils get larger, to let more light in, the blood supply to your muscles is increased, so you can run away. The blood supply to your skin is decreased, so you won't bleed so much, and so your skin feels cold. Your muscles start shaking. You get adrenaline delivered by the adrenal glands on your kidneys. A whole bunch of responses kick in, and one of them automatically is that the hair follicles, which used to have hair in them a few hundred thousand years ago, all have an erection and they stand up on end to make you look bigger and more scary, because suddenly you're 1 centimetre bigger in all directions because you've got hair sticking up.
Hair boners.
Hair boners. But we don't have the hair anymore. All we've got is the little hair follicles, and they are what the goosebumps are.
Right. Okay.
I'm sorry, and I hope we can do something for your disc with genetic engineering in years to come.
Best of luck, Ryan. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Let's head to Perth where Sam's on the line. Hey, Sam.
Good morning. How's everybody?
Fantastic. What's your question, Sam?
I want to know, when a bee stings a human, obviously the stinger comes out. Does that just happen with, like, humans and animals with thicker skin, or is that just like a lack of evolution or something that happens with everything they sting?
It's a deliberate thing. It's a deliberate sacrifice that they make in the bee. Firstly, in the bee, you've got three, call them genders. There's the males who basically exist just to have sex with the queen bee, and then they get booed out once their function is over. There's a queen bee who lives for about six years and who makes her own weight in eggs every day. The poor bugger. She is not the queen of the nest. She is the slave of the nest. And she's a female. There's the males. They get booed out. There's a female, and there's one female. And then there's all these sterile females. They're the workers, and they come in all sorts of different grades. There's the nurses and the hunters and the fighters and the take care of the babies and all that sort of stuff. And they each have only one ovary, which generally doesn't work. So they're not 100% sterile. Every now and then they will pop an egg, but it's very uncommon. And they, in general, they will not have a baby. And so by the only way that they can make sure that their DNA, now we're talking some evolutionary biology, that their DNA makes it to the next generation is by dying for the nest. Because they can't have a baby themselves, so they can protect the nest. So when she stings you, and it's a she, the sting goes under your skin, and then she either sits there or you brush her off. You brush her off, her sting and the venom sac and the muscles and the nerves and a lot of her gut stay behind.
Oh.
She's dying.
So can they sting you and like keep the stinger with them, or every time it like has to come out?
Virtually every time it has to come out. I read about this for my latest book, and I couldn't find a case of where they actually can gently say, okay, now you've gone, and I'll go and pull my sting out. So the advantage of that is that the sting stays there with the muscles, and it keeps on compressing and squirting venom into you. For you as a human, the thing is just to brush it off, either a straight pull or just a credit card swipe, and it'll get it off. And so this is a case where, for the good of all, she takes a dive for the hive.
Because she's the CEO of the hive.
Yes.
Thanks so much for the call, Sam.
No worries. Just a big shout out to WA Brickworks.
Did one.
Don't do that.
Oh, by the way, you didn't get a chocolate bunny from Zan like I did. Yeah.
Because you know how to follow ABC editorial policy, Dr. Carl.
I do.
Hey, quick question. How do you become a queen bee? I'm interested.
This is epigenetics.
Is it biological?
Yeah. Any of the eggs can become a queen, and it depends upon the royal jelly that's fed to them. So the bees in the nursery, they vomit up a secretion from different glands in their mouth and neck. And it's sort of this one and that one, and it's sort of 50% this and then 20, 30% that, and then it changes over time. The ones that are destined to become the queen bee, so the workers will say, well, we ain't got no queen. Let's make one. And so they'll start squirting up one of these juices from their mouth and give it only to, say, a dozen of the of eggs. And these will then turn into a fertile female that has two ovaries. So all of the...
I don't think I want to be queen anymore.
Well, not if you have to give your own weight in birth every
day. Receive some squirt from a bee.
Vomited squirt.
Oh, it's hard at the top, isn't it? Very, very hard. Thank you for answering that. Dr. Carl is with us. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call. His final science hour for 2013. Clayton is calling in from Cairns. Hi, Clayton.
How you going, guys?
Great. What's your question?
I'm going to roll with this question. I have two, but I'll roll with this one. Salt intake. Me and mate always having an argument about that. He reckons that eat too much salt all on my food. My argument is that if you're exercising heaps and sweating a lot, drinking plenty of water, does that make it okay? Like, you need the extra salt to stop cramping?
Both are true-ish, but the first one is true. So, in general, you need to have no more than 6 grams of salt a day. And it's just been discovered that if you like to have those painkillers, that when you dip them in water and they fizz up like crazy, if you have the maximum dose, you're then adding 150% over your normal daily limit. So instead of having 6 grams, you're having 9 grams just from the painkillers that fizz up.
Are you talking about the painkillers that get rid of headaches or the painkillers that...
No, I don't take any painkillers.
Oh, no, I'm asking Dr. Carl.
So this is the ones that get rid of headaches. And I have to mention a brand name because one doesn't. In Australia, the aspirin ones don't have that much sodium bicarbonate, but the Panadol ones do. Sorry, this was from the Daily Mail in England, so I don't know what the Australian situation is, but look on the side of the packet. So in general, too much salt is bad for you. It will, in many, many people, cause high blood pressure, and then all of the things that follow along with that. High blood pressure is what they call a symptomless disease. And in general,
table salt, what?
Table salt is the same stuff. Salt is salt. So you don't want to have too much sodium. But unless you're actually having problems with too low salt, do not add salt to anything. Although they add buckets of it in restaurants and on the cooking shows.
It lives in a lot of the food we already eat.
Yeah, you get enough in the food that you eat.
Thanks so much for the call, Clayton.
Okay.
See you later.
He was so sad. Don't add salt, Clayton. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Let's go to Melbourne where Mitch is on the line. Hey, Mitch.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks. What's your question?
Well, when people called my house when I was younger, even more so, my brother or my father or I answered the phone, people wouldn't be able to distinguish which one of us is on the phone. Mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking that might be like a growing up and hearing and sort of learning language from them. But how does it work so you develop, like, how can somebody who's listening that will know it's me on the radio know the sound of my voice? How does that work?
How do we recognise voices?
Yeah, and why would my father and my brother sound so similar to me that people wouldn't?
Oh, okay. Well, firstly, why people sound similar is genetics, number one, because speaking is a complicated thing that involves coordinated and highly complex mechanics between the movement of the diaphragm muscle and the lungs and the larynx, which originally was higher up in your throat and then moved down lower, and the inside of your mouth and your nose a bit, and your tongue. And so if you're genetically related, you tend to have a similarity in these areas. And then people who live together sound more similar. So studies have been done looking at people who are not related, who get married, and over the years they tend to sound more like each other, and they can even have the situation that they and their dog begin to look a bit like each other. There's a tendency there. So it's just simply being in proximity and adapting to the people around you so that they can understand you better, you can understand them better.
And that would be accents and all that as well.
I don't fully understand accents yet. I'm waiting for a good review article on that by somebody in linguistics. And if anybody has got it, but anyway, we'll leave it at that.
Thanks so much for the call, Mitch. Cheers.
Thanks. Bye.
Let's go to Dave in Adelaide. Hey, Dave.
G'day, Douglas. How you doing?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is, I was at the Sydney 500 on the weekend, and me and brother thought of the pretty question we couldn't work out. It was the car in front, obviously, the cold air going through the car is going to make it perform better, but then cars behind it, so the slipstream will give them an advantage, but they're getting the hot exhaust fumes into their car. And our question was, which is the better, in the cold air going through the car making it perform better, or the slipstream with the aerodynamics?
So a car will perform better if it can generate more horsepower, just a single car by itself. And so the more petrol it can burn in that engine, the better. So you have things called superchargers and turbochargers.
Yep.
But you can also get the same effect by running the car in the dead of night because the air is colder and therefore denser. And so in the same volume of air, they know, sorry, in the same volume of air, you'll have more air molecules so you can support the burning of more petrol. So that's why they try to run cooler air into the burning fuel part of the engine so as to get better performance. Then you have the other effect that you've just mentioned, the slipstreaming behind somebody, and I would bet that with the improved performance from the cold air, that'd be only 1% or 2%, but by slipstreaming, you can get an extra 5 kilometres per hour and save more fuel. I think from what I've been reading the American magazines Car and Driver and Road and Track, and also Wheels, the good Australian magazine. And it does seem that you get more advantage by slipstreaming, and the fact that you're running hotter air into your engine and losing a bit of horsepower, that effect is a minor effect, and you're getting a greater advantage from the slipstreaming.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Dave.
Great, doctors.
Dr. Carl, you've had a couple of answers come through while that song was on. Tell us what you've learned.
Firstly, I forgot to mention that the first queen bee that is born kills the others before they're born. And Mr. Fuller has said, or Cy Fuller has said, think of the queen bee not as the slave of the hive, but the genitals.
Nice.
And then Lex talking about the cars following each other, saying that, yes, slipstreaming is indeed very effective in straight lines, but going around corners not so good. And the turbulent air destroys the downforce that keeps them stuck to the road. Hence, they have less grip and more tyre wear and heat, which means that overall, especially when they're travelling at super high speeds, like in the Formula One cars, they try to spend a little bit of time in the slipstream, but not too much, because overall, it will ruin their race strategy. So overall, clean air is better, but a little bit of slipstream is okay, but not too much.
Thank you to everyone texting and tweeting in your answers. We always appreciate it. Let's hang around in that realm of air and cars. Mark in Sydney's got a question on that. Good morning, Mark.
Hi.
Hello. What's your question?
It's a two-parter.
Yeah.
Why is it that when you're travelling in a car and you put one window down, the wind makes a thumping noise?
The thumping noise is because a standing wave has been set up between one side of the car and the other side of the car. So it's imagine you've got something like a cone, and the tip of the cone is kissing the glass that's shut, and then the open side of the cone is where the open window is, and that's half a wavelength. And so it can cause actual physical pain where your ears actually hurt. And in the ABC studios where we are now, there are ribulations on the ceiling, there are holes in the wall, there's carpet, and the big sheets of glass are tilted. They are not parallel to the walls, they're aimed slightly down the ground so that we do not set up a standing wave like this.
Quite right. Never thought about that.
Mm. So what's happened is you've set up a standing wave, and unfortunately, thanks to the dimensions of the car, you know, 1.5 to 2 metres across on the inside, it's in some low frequency that hurts like buggery.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Okay.
Thank you.
Speaking of air, did you just burp into the mic?
Yes. I had so much water. I might have drunk some alcohol yesterday at a party, and I might be a bit dehydrated, or I might not.
Real talk with Dr. Carl. Rowan in Frankston, save us from ourselves. What's your question?
Yeah, g'day.
Hello.
I've had a problem for ages, and I've been trying to get on Dr. Carl, so I'm so glad that I finally got the chance to do it.
Hey, Rowan, are you on hands-free?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Keep talking. We love you.
Okay. My cat urinated in the back room on the carpet, and obviously, you know, cat, we smell. So I tried to I sprayed bleach on it. That didn't work. No, vinegar first, sorry. Then I put bleach on it. Then I used a bioenzyme to try and to clean it in a cleaner. Now, it's got rid of the smell, but every time I've gone in there, I get, like, splitting headaches and feel nauseous. I've been looking online for ages. I just need something that can, do you know, anything that can neutralise. I think it might have created, like, a, you know, vinegar mixed with bleach can make, like, a carbon monoxide gas or something.
Mm.
Is there anything I can use to neutralise it?
Well, the first thing I do is go to the chemist or a high school and then just bludge some sort of indicator that tells you whether you've got an acid or an alkaline mix left there. I'm guessing if you use the vinegar, you've got an acid mix there, but the bioenzyme might have also had a bit of alkaline, which might have changed the pH. So try to find out where it is, and then the first thing to do is add something relatively neutral like bleach. Sodium bicarbonate.
Yeah, someone on Twitter is saying bicarbonate of soda will fix it.
That'll resist the acidity, but it might be there's too alkaline. It could be something with the bleachy, you know, the bioenzyme stuff. So if it was me, and if it was an ideal world, you just simply wash the bugger. wash and wash and wash, but the trouble is almost certainly the carpet is stuck to the floor, and so every time you try to dry it, you have to have a long, it takes you days to dry it, then you wet it and you dry it.
Steam cleaning?
Steam, oh, yeah. Why don't I think of that?
Mm.
I've done all that. I'm unfazed. I've actually ripped up the carpet, but like even it's like this, it's still in the air. I've aired out the room and everything. It's like, I don't know if it, can it penetrate walls or furniture
yes.
or whatever?
Yes, those surfaces can be porous. Do you have a wooden floor?
Yeah.
Yeah, can have gone into the wood. You don't want to start chopping the floor up.
Don't know how much more we can help you, Ron, but best of luck. Maybe get a professional in.
Yeah, what sort of professional,
thanks.
Though?
Good on you. Thanks for your
cheers.
Time.
Thanks for
chemist?
That.
Yeah, university chemist, industrial chemist.
I was thinking a cleaner, but sure, let's go with chemist.
Yeah. Oh, well, based by that show that Sean McAuliffe was in, get Mr. and Mrs. Murder in.
Oh, yeah. Well, they can clean up some pretty bad stuff.
Yeah.
Barbara is calling in from Sydney with a question. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi.
Hello.
I just wanted to ask, I had a deja vu the other day and I was in a really unique situation and it reminded me of a dream that I had had months ago. So I just wanted to know how deja vus work.
Okay, the best theory, which is not perfect, says it is related to the time delay in processing vision, comma, and there is a man who hears what you're saying before he sees your lips move.
Okay.
Okay, so firstly, now we'll talk about the time delay. So the photons of light land upon your retina. They get turned into electricity, they get processed in your retina, and then it gets sent to the optic nerve, and then it gets sent to the back of your head, and then the whole thing gets deconvoluted in the Brodmann's areas 17, 18 and 19, two areas of your brain, one on each side, that are roughly the size of a baby's clenched fist, and they turn this electricity into vision, which takes 300 milliseconds, 0.3 of a second. Now, that means that you're always living behind reality. Yes, the hippies were right. Reality is for people who can't handle drugs. So 0.3 of a second is a long time if there's a killer kangaroo coming for you. So along the way, between your eyes and the back of your head, part of it is fed off, this is the theory, into a stream where it's low res. It's not fully processed. It takes about 100 milliseconds, a tenth of a second, but at least you can see the killer rabbit coming. And so you're always looking out for threats and you're always throwing that information away.
Wow. Okay.
And sometimes it doesn't get thrown away. Sometimes this early stream, which has been analysed for a threat, leaks into your consciousness. And so for a whole 0.2 of a second, 200 milliseconds, you're aware that somebody's going to come around around the door and say hello to you. Now, to get to the guy. So we've got this guy who is a retired, highly intelligent pilot who had a little bit of a hiccup in his brain, and as a result, he can now hear what you're saying before he sees your lips move. Works with the TV too. And what happened was that this delay has been removed in his audio. There's a delay in your audio. An audio file is much smaller than a video file. So normally you can process your audio in one-tenth of a second, 100 milliseconds, and then your brain deliberately adds in a 200-millisecond delay. And this is so that when you're talking with me across the kitchen table, there's no disconcerting gap between your lips moving and hearing what you're saying. So the disadvantage is that you don't get that early warning of a threat through the ears, but the advantage is that you can be part of society.
Wow, okay.
Okay, so there's a lot of stuff going on with your brain and reality.
The sound.
Oh, my God.
You might have to play
Barbara's mind being blown.
Yeah, play the podcast back. It's complicated. It took me a long time to work it out. And sometimes when I'm listening to a science podcast, I have to play it back six or seven times. I have to pull over the side of the road.
I might have to do that.
You can definitely do that. You can download Dr. Carl's podcast and listen to it over and over again. Thanks so much, Barbara.
Thank you, Dr. Barbara.
You.
See you later. Gabrielle in Newtown is on the phone and she has an answer for us. Good morning, Gabrielle.
Good morning, Dr. Carl. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
What do you do for a living, Gabrielle?
I am a forensic cleaner. So you mentioned the Mr. and Mrs. Murder, and that's what I do for a living.
You're kidding. Were they fairly accurate? And
No.
No?
No. I mean, when you've got a cat and it's urinating in a property on a surface, first of all, you've got to evaluate, you know, is it a one-off or has the cat been doing it for like 3 years? So ideally, depending on how long it's been going on for, especially if it was a one-off, you would call a carpet cleaner who would steam clean the carpet and use enzymes, or what's commonly known as ammonia, to break down the protein in the fabric, and you know, reduce the smell and clean it all up. Mm. But if it's something that has been going on for, say, 3 years, of course, it's going to do a lot of damage to the carpet, the underlay, and then you also have to look at what is under the underlay. Is it a cement slab? Is it chipboard? Is it floorboards? And of course, in this case, the gentleman that rang up said that he had floorboards, and again, too, depending on how long it had been there, you know, it's done damage. So it would probably need to be replaced, especially when he said that every time he goes into the room, he would feel sort of sick and squeezy, juicy smell. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for those tips, Gabrielle.
Thank you.
For helping us out, and for the caller before whose cat was weeing in the room and he's covered it up with so many chemicals and now he feels sick. Yeah. We really appreciate it, Gabrielle. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
See you later.
I like the way Gabrielle just said, might have to replace the floor.
Yeah.
That's it. I felt reluctant to say that.
She works in a business where she cleans up after dead bodies, so I'm sure she's used to replacing lots of things. Casey's calling in from Campbelltown. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Casey.
Hey,
how
guys.
Are you?
Hi. Thank you. Congratulations on the number one.
Thank you very much, Casey. Did you buy it?
I did.
Legend.
Thank
you. That means you get to ask Dr. Carl a question. What's your question?
Fantastic. Well, I'm a redhead, and I've been told by a few people that redheads have a higher pain tolerance and are more tolerant to anaesthesia, and I'm wondering if it's true and how.
I'm trying to remember. I wrote this in a book several years ago, but just suddenly into my mind popped the three magic letters MCR1. MCR, melanocortin receptor 1, and this receptor is firstly involved in melano, the dye that gives you hair colour and skin colour. Firstly, this receptor is involved in creating your hair colour, and secondly, in pain reception. Now, I can't remember whether it made the redheads, I think more's coming through, a kappa opioid was involved, a kappa opioid, K-A-P-P-A opioid receptor was involved, but I can't remember whether it made the more redheads more wussy or more tough with regard to pain. And I seem to remember that there was a follow-up paper which then disputed that. So my basic knowledge is, yes, there was something on about it in the past, and I can't remember the details, and it might have been disputed since then. If you could give me 5 minutes, I could probably find, or probably 5 hours, I could get the right answer for you. Can't do it that quickly. Sorry.
Thanks for the call, Casey.
That's fine. Thank you.
I think we've got time for one more, and it's Hayley in Adelaide, who is the lucky last caller for the year. Hey, Hayley.
Hey guys, how are you?
Great. Good. What's your question?
I was just wondering. My sister asked this a couple months back, and it's got me thinking ever since. There's no real air in space, so what would the rate of decomposition be for a body?
I think it would be freeze-dried. So the water content of the body is about 40 to 60%, depending on what age you are. The water would vanish instantly, leaving behind ruptured cells. The bacteria, which are the main cause of decomposition, would also die through dehydration. You would then be effectively freeze-dried, and you would have a massive change from being alive to being freeze-dried. But once you are freeze-dried, the only other effect would be the slow rain of micrometeorites and the solar wind particles on you over the next millennia. So if you were carefully placed on the surface of the moon, you wouldn't change a lot, which reminds me, I've got to tell you, so basically you wouldn't do much decaying. But it's the Geminids. Geminids, now is the Geminids. Go out tonight at after 10:30 and look north and look for the Geminids. Look it up, G-E-M-I-N-I-D-S, meteor storm about 120 per hour. You might be lucky. Yeah, look up Geminids on the ABC, on the Twitter feed.
Thanks so much for the call, Hayley.
Thank you.
Freeze-dried body, that's awesome.
Blowing minds till the very end, Dr. Carl. And thank you to everyone who's called up with your great questions all through 2013. Dr. Carl will be returning on the 23rd of January for another big year of Science Talkback. I know it's many people's favourite part of the week. We thank you for taking part. And I thank you, Dr. Carl, for coming in every Thursday and blowing everyone's minds, dancing in between the songs and just being an all-round legend. Thank you for another great year of Science Talkback.
And thanks to the audience for coming up with the great questions.
Absolutely. Shout out to Lockie Makara and also Max Quinn, the guys at the front line taking all your calls and making sure they get safely to us. We really appreciate it. We'll see you in 2014. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Peachy Keen.